As we go to air, Illinois lawmakers are reportedly returning to Springfield next week. We'll talk with Senate Majority Leader Kim Lightford about what might be on the agenda. Lightford's also chair of the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus, and we'll ask her about the disproportionate toll COVID-19 has taken on African Americans in Illinois. Meanwhile, high school seniors and college students are facing uncertainty about what the fall semester might look like. Some are considering a gap year, or at least a gap semester, because of the pandemic. We'll talk about that with a student, an admissions director, and a school counselor. Plus, a conversation about the Chicago Bulls dynasty, Michael Jordan's legacy, and the ESPN miniseries The Last Dance. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st, a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. The news is next. Welcome back to the, or welcome to the 21st, I should say. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air Wednesday morning, the Illinois General Assembly says it'll reconvene for session next week. It will be the first meeting of the legislature in more than 2 months and comes as Illinois now has more than 83,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19. Among those, 3,601 of our fellow Illinoisans have been killed by the disease. The Illinois House of Representatives will reportedly be meeting in a large convention center in downtown Springfield, the better for its 118 members, staffers, lobbyists, and the press to do business from a responsible social distance. The Senate, with half that number of lawmakers, will be meeting in their usual location in the Capitol building, but of course, nothing in this pandemic is happening as usual. Joining us to talk about this and more is Senate Majority Leader Kimberly Lightford. She's the number two Democrat in the Illinois Senate from Maywood and representing parts of Chicago and its western suburbs. She's also chair of the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus. Leader Lightford, thanks for joining us this, I'm sure, busy morning on the 21st.
Oh, thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
So I understand Senate Democrats have been meeting in caucus this morning. What is the latest? What can you tell us about the General Assembly's plans for next week?
Well, thus far, what you spoke of is totally accurate. We will be on site next week, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, in order to keep the state moving forward. We'd like to make sure we focus on some sort of COVID release package. We're hoping to have a capital reappropriation bill. We have constitutional amendments to address, and of course, our budget. And so there's items that we just have to move. You know, the feeling of being an essential worker is definitely something that I've thought about others and prayed for them, and now it's my turn to make sure that we continue with our business before May 31st.
Sure. And obviously there's a lot that I'm sure will be on the agenda. And I want to come back to that idea of essential workers, because I know that's been something that you have focused on in your Senate career for a long time now, people in terms of the minimum wage and other things. But sticking with the legislative session for now, what is session going to look like? I mean, session is usually a time of handshaking and quiet, close conversations as people are, you know, working out their differences on issues. I don't think anyone is quite prepared for, you know, how different this could be. Can you talk a little bit about what sort of rules might be in place?
Yeah, we're still trying to finalize how it would actually look. We know that we will not have staff that we generally would have. We're trying to do as much virtual prior to arriving on that Wednesday. So all of the legislative matters that we're addressing, we've had these subgroups convene twice a week for the last 5 or 6 weeks. So all of our legislative issues, we've been, you know, still in the grind, moving things forward, and each work group will have a package. So we, during that time, decided which legislative initiatives were COVID-19 related that we needed to address right away, which initiatives that perhaps could just as important, but could hold off into veto session. And then those items that we thought could just wait until next spring to file over again. So we did a lot of breaking things down already. So we know what those legislative initiatives are in every single category. But
sure.
Some of the bigger, most difficult ticket items is just addressing the budget shortfall, trying to find a place where we can make sure our pension obligations are met, making sure we reappropriate capital so that we can keep the economy moving in terms of roads and bridges and projects and things of that nature going. The constitutional amendments that were going to be on the ballot for the November election, still making sure those things are in play. So as 59 of us find our way into our offices, we'll be limited to movement. We'll have food sent into our offices, of course, and then we'll do on the Senate floor. We're still now. That's our sticking point, that we've not fully realized how we're going to vote. If we're going to vote in groups, where there'll be 20 at a time spread out across the complete floor, and there'll be three separate voting, or if one person will go and vote on behalf of four or five people. We just don't know yet how that'll look. We're trying to make sure we stay within confines of the Constitution as much as possible, but we're trying to also keep members safe and making sure that we get our job done diligently, but safe as well.
Sure. Now we've heard a lot of pushback, particularly from parts of Illinois that have not seen at least as many confirmed cases. There are probably still cases in these places, but maybe the official numbers are a little bit lower. Pushback on some of the governor's closure orders and an eagerness to have people begin circulating and going to businesses sooner. Do you have a sense of what the legislature, whether the legislature is going to weigh in? So far, it's just been Governor Pritzker who has been sort of making these rules for the state of Illinois during this pandemic. Do you think the legislature needs to step up and codify some of these things that have been done through executive orders so far?
Well, I do not. I believe that the governor and his team has done a very good job, including Mayor Lightfoot. We do know that there are parts of the state that are not as heavily impacted as parts that have, of course, larger populations. But just think of that. We're all coming from all across the state right now to convene in the Capitol building. And that's why it's still so important for us to be safe, because if your region or your part of the state has not hugely been impacted, but now you're going to be coming into contact with those who've been in areas who have been hugely impacted, you have the potential of being a carrier and carrying this back to your region and part of the state. And so when all this movement start happening, that's when all the shakeup, even more so, is going to continue to happen. And, as of yesterday, we had 3,601 deaths in the state of Illinois, and no one can deny that that is a tragedy. And so I think we ought to continue to be mindful that even though it may not be in your part of the state and you feel safe, once you begin to come into contact with others who are in large metropolitan areas, you become at a greater risk and you take that back to your community.
And you mentioned the number of deaths, 3,601, and we know that a significant share of those deaths, much greater than should be based on the population demographics of Illinois, have been people in the African-American community, and now we're also learning more in the Latino community as well. And as chair of the Black Caucus, is there something that you think the legislature should be doing or that Illinois should be doing differently to address this disparity?
Well, let me tell you, Brian, there's of those deaths, that number, 32% of them are of African Americans. So 1,166 are deaths of African Americans. And I think the legislature can play a role as it relates to post-COVID. Right now, as the Black Caucus, we've been fighting really hard to ensure additional test sites in our communities, recognizing the healthcare disparities that we've had in chronic diseases around heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, smoking-related issues. So we know that these chronic diseases are apt to or prone to COVID-19. And then we also know that we're mainly essential workers. We may not be all of the doctors and the nurses, but we're definitely the cashiers, the driver, the bus driver. You know, we're the ones who are in the hospitals, the maintenance, cleaning up behind the doctors and nurses and coming into contact with them. So we're definitely out here as essential workers and on the front lines. And then there's also that part of the community that I don't know, for whatever wild reason, feel like they're in regions in the state that's not being impacted, and they're not as responsible with their PPE as they should be. So there's some dynamics because we come from a lot of generational homes. So we have young people in the home with the elderly, and they may be okay, but they're transmitting that to their elderly family members. And so their grandparents are dying of COVID. Their older uncles and aunts are dying of COVID because they're in the same household with them. And so what I've asked as chairman of the Black Caucus of the governor, his team, is to be fair with resources and look at areas that Mayor Lightfoot clearly provided data that showed zip codes and where the high proportion of COVID cases were coming from and the high deaths were coming from in the African-American community. So we did right away begin to increase test sites in those areas and provide more PPE. The Black Caucus ourselves have been donating masks and making purchases of PPE and getting this material out and the education behind it to our communities. But as we're moving forward, we need support in hitting that restart button. How do we get our small Black business back moving in our communities? How do we help with those who have not received any supports in unemployment? Domestic violence is on the rise. A lot of our children have not been connected, no connectivity due to either no laptop in the home or no Wi-Fi, or grandparents raising their grandchildren. They don't have the access, the resources, or even the know-how to help them with their homework. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of issues that we've been facing that I feel will carry over. And so we've put together subgroups within our caucus around specific issues so that we can create a platform to here is what we suggest could be done and should be done in order to help us restart the Black community post-COVID.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st. We're speaking with Illinois Senate Majority Leader Kim Lightfoot. Leader Lightfoot, I wanted to ask, and you mentioned just a moment ago, this idea of essential workers. And I think that in our society, we have sort of gotten a new awakening to what workers are essential to our lives when the rubber really meets the road, to mix metaphors there. But, grocery store clerks, people who, not just the physicians and the nurses, but the people who clean the hospitals, trash collectors, mm-hmm. people like that. And you have long worked on minimum wage is been a big issue of yours in the legislature. You passed the legislation to get it increased over the next few years to $15 an hour, starting last year. Do you think this is a time in just the 2 or 3 minutes we have remaining here to sort of re-envision the social contract and the way that our society treats these workers? Is there an opportunity going forward here?
Well, I've got to tell you, Brian, this pandemic has really opened up a lot of challenges all at once. And a lot of things that we've been fighting for, fair wages, for living wages, for fairness on the job as it relates to sick days and insurance, and all of these things all have come to the surface and hit all at once. And I think that this is a clear example that you find in the nursing home crisis, for example. You had CNAs there that were underpaid. They didn't want to give them additional support They were not provided PPEs. Many of them were becoming ill. And not only were they infecting each other, they were infecting the patients. And then you begin to see the rise of deaths in nursing homes. So I was a huge supporter of those healthcare workers and ensuring that they were treated fairly and that they were protected and that the institution saw them as viable enough to want to make sure that they were healthy. And so these are the things that, yes, will be high on the pole of discussion around protecting all workers, not just those who, and just in this example, not just the emergency room doctor or not just the high-end nurse, but the nurse's assistants that prep the patients to get them ready for the doctors, those that are in the kitchens, that are cooking the food for the hospital, and they're cleaning up behind all of the patients. I mean, those are the individuals that need to be supported, need to be reminded that they are a crucial part of our society and our fabric and our everyday living of what we need to do. And I will continue to fight and advocate. I'm working on a bill right now around sick pay and sick pay leave. I mean, you know, there's still a lot of people who can't get 5 days of sick days in a year, and that's unbelievable. And so it's one of those things that hopefully a lot of these injustices, a lot of these disparities and inequities that have been clearly shown here can continue to be addressed now with an open lens, with a different mindset of those who originally wasn't in support of these things or maybe just couldn't see it, you know. But now none of us should be blindsided at this point. We all know of an invisible killer and something that we need to band together around and support one another and support those essential workers like none before. They are very crucial, critical part of our everyday living.
Senator Kim Lightford is the Majority Leader of the Illinois Senate. Senator Lightford, thanks so much for speaking with us today on the 21st, and stay safe.
Thank you, Brian, for having me, and you stay safe also. Take care.
More to come after a short break. You're listening to the 21st. Stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. High school seniors missed out on a lot this spring. Graduations are now virtual, prom has been canceled, and in-person end-of-year parties will have to be put on hold or at least happen at a distance. There's the additional worry and uncertainty many are facing about their fall semester at college as well and how it might look different than they had envisioned. It's a question captured in this Saturday Night Live sketch from last weekend where Kate McKinnon plays a principal hosting a high school graduation on Zoom.
The good news is you're all getting diplomas. The bad news is you're about to pay full price for fancy colleges when they're all just University of Phoenix online with worse tech support.
U of P Online represent! The future's in wires!
A.D. Bryant, a proud Columbia College Chicago graduate there on last weekend's SNL. It's not just those heading off to college or possibly taking online courses that are questioning their plans for the upcoming semester, but also current students. Dennis Austin recently transferred to the University of Illinois Urbana from a community college. We hope he'll be joining us a little bit later, but with us now is Jeff Mavros. He's director of admissions at Illinois State University in Normal, an institution with more than 18,000 undergraduates. Jeff, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much, Brian. Happy to be with you.
And Professor Heidi Troe joins us as well. She's a professor of school counseling at Roosevelt University and is a counselor at Simpson Academy for Young Women. She's also 2020 Illinois School Counselors Association Counselor of the Year this year. Heidi, congratulations and thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And now joining us, Dennis Austin, recently transferred to the U of I Urbana from a community college. He's considering a gap semester because of the pandemic. Dennis, thanks for being with us. Okay, maybe we will still work on that. Live radio, folks. As a reminder, you can join our conversation. If you or someone you know is considering taking a gap year or a gap semester, give us a call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. That's 21st Show. Heidi, I want to begin with you. The school where you work, Simpson Academy for Young Women, is for young mothers, and all of them have college ambitions in the future. How has this year been different because of the pandemic for the students you work with?
In so many ways, you know, it started out pretty normal, other than, you know, I am a Chicago public school, so we did have the strike earlier on in the year. So there's already some disruption. But since the pandemic has come into place, we've seen a lot of our students really have to consider their whole post-secondary trajectory in a different way, because their needs have changed so much in light of COVID and instability around employment for their support system.
And Jeff, how about you? How have admissions at Illinois State University been different this year?
Much like Heidi said, the start of the year was very much like any other. And we certainly, as a school that recruits and enrolls a good number of CPS students, went through the strike in maybe a slightly different way, but also were affected by that. But as the year went on, it was a very strong year for us, and things looked really good. And, you know, COVID hit and just everything changed. And so it's, we've adjusted like everybody else has. And so it's been a very different spring than what I would say a typical spring has looked like.
Are you seeing a lot of prospective students ask about gap years or a gap semester?
You know, we've gotten some of those questions, Brian. You know, when you say, have we seen that from a lot of students? Hard to quantify that. I mean, I haven't gone back and looked at how many of those requests we've gotten. These things also seem to kind of ebb and flow. And so as somebody has questions, and I think folks are out there talking, we start seeing kind of a trend in the questions that we get. And then that will die down, and there'll be, you know, kind of a new interest of folks, and we'll get a series of new questions. So we did for a little while there field some questions around a delay in a start or a gap year and those sorts of things. And we've tried to counsel people through some of that, but we're not getting a lot of that at this time.
Okay. And Dennis, are you with us now? Okay. We'll come back to Dennis. Heidi, I want to return to you then and ask what concerns you're hearing from students about the fall in particular.
Several different things. So we've had about, throughout the district, but even at my very small school, 10 to 15% of students have needed to change their plans from college to employment, simply so they can secure housing, because so many people have lost their positions here in Chicago. And then on top of that, we see our students who are planning to go away, some to Iowa or to Michigan, to experience that out-of-state experience, who are now wondering if it's safe for them to go, what housing will look like. So just seeing a lot of consideration around what is the best for myself and for our students, their babies as well, considering all the health implications that come along with going to a four-year university that might require them to stay on campus.
And you're also, Heidi, part of the Illinois Association of Counselors. I wonder, what concerns are you hearing from your fellow high school counselors?
Absolutely, yeah. So the Illinois School Counselor Association has been working hard to serve school counselors during this time. They're hosting webinars each week. And so we're getting to hear from school counselors across the state. And universally, we're hearing that about 10% of students are needing to change plans away from college or university settings towards employment. Not so much a gap year, because traditionally when we think about gap years, we're actually thinking about volunteer programs like AmeriCorps or Serve Illinois, but a literal just, I need to step away and earn money to take care of sort of my basic needs. So that's pretty universal. The other consideration we're hearing a lot is there's another subset of students that were really planning to go into what we call these middle employment preparation universities, certificates, vocational programs, And those programs are having a hard time, even more than us that are working in traditional universities. So much of their learning is experiential. You can't, you know, pull apart an engine online. So to go and get that mechanics certificate has now become an additional barrier. So it's creating some jeopardy pretty universally across Illinois.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. That was Heidi Tro, clinical assistant professor of school counseling at Roosevelt University and a counselor at Simpson Academy for Young Women. We're also speaking with Jeff Mavros, director of missions at Illinois State University in Normal, and Dennis Austin, who's a transfer student at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Dennis, as a student at the U of I understand you're considering a gap semester. What factors are going into your decision?
Well, the issue is mainly financial. And I want to say that while the university has done a pretty good job in making sure that, you know, financially we've been taken care of to an extent, there's the CARES Act disbursements, there's the prorated refund disbursements. The issue mainly here is money. You know, I am a low-income student. And when our guests were speaking on somewhat of a, it's not so much a gap year, it is so much employment, that is correct. You know, most of us who attend these universities, we don't come from very wealthy families. We don't come from a lot of backgrounds where we have mass resources as compared to some of our more privileged peers. So we're in an environment where being on campus, in many cases, we're away from our neighborhoods where there's crime. We're away from our neighborhoods where there's drugs and other real-life unfortunate scenarios. So now that we're back in these communities and our opportunities have kind of dwindled, specifically when it comes to the current education scenario, we have to find other ways of trying to keep things afloat. And these things are really difficult to do if you are a low-income student like I and so many other people who attend colleges across the state and across the country.
You know, and if it's not too personal, Dennis, I understand that you and your mother are immunocompromised, if you're willing to talk about that. How is that affecting your decision?
It's affecting my decision a lot. I'm a lot more careful of what I do. And, you know, this is why I've been, you know, proactively telling people that this is not a joke. I was fell ill when I was a teenager with kidney disease and high blood pressure. I still suffer from those, too. So I would know what it's like to be in an ICU for a period of time on oxygen. My mother is on dialysis, so she has that experience. And, you know, right now it's just walking on a tightrope. The advantage that I have over her to a degree is that I'm younger. But as statistics show, if you have one or more comorbidity, your chances of death increase significantly. So for me, it's not so much only the issue of getting an education. It's, is this going to be a safe environment for me to return? I keep hearing universities talk about trying to socially distance campus. We have a major, we have a massive campus. There's 20 to 30,000 students at any given one point, not to mention the faculty, which is numerous, not to mention the community members who live in the Twin Cities of Urbana-Champaign, which are many. How are you going to socially distance that feasibly? So that's one of the concerns I have for my health.
Okay. If you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. That was Dennis Austin. He's a student at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, considering whether to take the fall semester off. We're also speaking with Heidi Truax, who is a counselor at Simpson Academy for Young Women, and Jeff Mavros, director of admissions at Illinois State in Normal. Jeff, I want to ask about the campus experience and being on campus, as we just heard Dennis talking about. I mean, Bloomington Normal's ranked as one of the top 40 college towns, our producer tells me. It seems like that is part of the draw for many prospective students, is being able to be there or at least to visit it when, you know, considering college. Has that been a concern? How are you showing the campus off to prospective students? Let's start with that.
Sure. So there's a lot there. First of all, yeah, absolutely. I think the residential on-campus experience is a draw for our students, but it's also something that we believe in really strongly. I think it's part of why, and Dennis brought up some really great points about the things that need to be taken very seriously in any calculation about coming back and coming back too soon potentially, or coming back in different formats. So we've been trying to play out just about every scenario to provide students what we think is a very meaningful experience, both in the classroom and outside of the classroom, and at the same time making sure that we're not jeopardizing the health of the students and our campus community. So those are really important and very serious calculations that those folks on campus who are responsible for making those decisions are looking into each and every day. To your question about how we're showing off the campus, you know, we, like so many of our peer institutions, had to pivot very quickly to provide more robust online opportunities than we had previously. And so most institutions, I think, have been very familiar with virtual tours and potentially even one-on-one appointments and things of that nature. But I think those things were not nearly as utilized or as leaned upon as they are now, because it's almost the sole way to look at a school if you're a prospective student and try to evaluate your fit at one institution over another. And so we've tried to make our staff as accessible as possible throughout the week and in various ways, but all of them virtual. And so that certainly does pale in comparison to physically being able to walk the campus and meet the faculty and staff and our students personally and to find that fit that's so important for both an institution and, of course, the student and their family. And so it's hamstrung us to a degree, but we're all in that same situation. And I think everybody's doing the best they can. But there are real considerations here around, yes, absolutely, we want students to be back on campus this fall, and we're doing everything we can to make that a reality. And at the same time, we have to take everybody's health and well-being as our top priority, take it very seriously.
So Dennis, given that you now have done, 8 weeks of e-learning this spring, I wonder if you have advice for any prospective students who say, you know what, I want to go on with my university career no matter what. Do you have any advice for them if they're definitely enrolling this fall?
If they're definitely enrolling this fall, be careful as much as you can. I know that's a very, vapid response, but it's just all we can provide for any of us in this conversation at this time. Be careful, be safe. I'm sure the universities will have specific safety protocols in place, but here's my main concern. You know, I'm at Walmart over the weekend, and on the ground of the floor, they have these little directions. Maybe you've seen them, where it's like, go this way, don't go this way, go that way. And people are just crisscrossing all over the place. They're not paying any attention to the signs. So while I do think that initially the first week, maybe 2 weeks, people are going to be on a good behavior, you know, what about week three, week four, you know, humans being humans? I think another option for families, if finances are a problem, and for many families it is a problem because so many businesses are currently shut down permanently or temporarily, you may want to start talking about the possibility of maybe attending a community college in the interim, if a university may not be something feasible because of what's going on right now. I transferred from a community college. So if the issue is whether or not the community college is of proper quality or anything like that, I had professors on staff who were able to get degrees from UCLA, Princeton, Brown University. It's what you make of it in any academic setting. So, you know, my advice is look at your options right now, particularly to the younger students, because I'm significantly older. I'm in my mid-20s now. Welcome to reality. Welcome to adulthood. Not everything's going to go your way. I grew up in a pretty rough part of town in the city, in the south side of Chicago. And I learned from an early age that, you know, there may be difficulties as to what you're trying to accomplish, but it doesn't mean you can't fully obtain those goals. It just means you have to navigate differently. So that's my advice to the younger generation. Things are going to look and feel different. That doesn't mean you should give up or you should stop what you're doing, but it means you'll have to be creative.
All right. And Heidi Truex, last question to you. As a counselor, and we only have about 30 seconds left, I'm sorry to say, but what do you hope colleges and universities keep in mind about students returning to campus or going to college for the first time?
Oh, just the transitioning to college is already a terrifying experience. And that's in the best of circumstances for those of us that are the most prepared. So particularly in this situation where students have only experienced campus virtually sometimes and are transitioning at the level of rigor, but also transitioning potentially housing, transitioning in that classroom experience, which we know is tremendously different from college to high school. It's even more different if we're going from high school to college online, and just allowing a lot of flexibility and forgiveness and communication and supports to make sure that students are still able to do that transition successfully.
Okay. Heidi Truax is a counselor at Simpson Academy for Young Women. We've also been speaking with Dennis Austin, U of I student, and Jeff Mavros, Director of Admissions at Illinois State. Thank you all so much for being here. More to come on the 21st after a short break. Stay with us. Listening to The 21st, I'm Brian Mackey.
To hometown Chicago fans, winning the big one is starting to feel almost like a constitutional right as the Bulls took their fifth NBA title on Friday night.
Count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 NBA championship trophies.
That is where the new documentary miniseries The Last Dance begins. It's 1997, and after 5 championships and 7 seasons, the future of the Chicago Bulls organization is in doubt. Aside from star Michael Jordan, other players are aging, the coach and management are at odds, and the word rebuilding is on everyone's lips. So the stage is set for a tumultuous and historic Last Dance. The new 10-part ESPN miniseries follows Jordan's last season with the Bulls. You can watch the last 2 episodes of the series on Sunday, but in the meantime, we're going to be talking about it today with Rich McBride. Fans of Illini basketball will remember Rich as part of the 2005 Final Four team. Today, he's an assistant men's basketball coach at Moberly Community College in Missouri. Rich, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And if you want to share your memories of the Bulls, give us a call, 800-222-9455. Rich, you grew up in Springfield in the 1990s, and I'm guessing you would have been, what, 10, 11 years old in 1997?
Yeah, I was 12.
12, okay. So can you talk about what it was like to watch Jordan play as yourself, a young basketball player? Did watching him and the success of the Bulls play a role in your desire to play and to be good?
It definitely did. Just growing up in a family that, you know, I had a lot of good basketball players in my family, my cousins, my uncles, to play college ball. And, you know, so they kind of got me started. But for sure, you know, coming up as a young teenager, going to the parks, watching the Bulls and Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen on TV, WGN to be exact, definitely played a part in, you know, me and trying to, you know, be as successful as possible in basketball.
You know, and I want to talk a little bit more about Jordan in a moment, but I also want to touch on another major character in the miniseries, who is Coach Phil Jackson. So after Rich, after your playing career, you became a coach yourself. I wonder, in your view, how important was Phil Jackson to the Bulls' success in the 1990s?
You know, he's very, very important. He's not, you know, considered the greatest of all time for no reason. I think being able to manage those personalities that he had and, you know, being able to adapt to different situations. You saw the situation he had with Rodman when Pippen went out and Pippen came back and he needed that vacation. You know, just being able to adapt in little situations like that. I mean, you know, everybody knows X's and O's is a big part, but I think off the court, getting everybody to gel and being able to, you know, control those personalities is just as important, and I think he was one of the best at that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess people could say, like, oh, he only won because he had Michael and Scottie and Rodman, but, I mean, there's more to the story, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think being able to get those guys to jail, being able to get those guys to play for each other, I think is just as important as having a Michael and Scotty. You know, you can always have the talent. You look at the NBA now, I mean, it's full of talent up and down every roster. I mean, you don't make it to that level without being really good. But, you know, if you ain't gelling off the court and you ain't got a good staff that supports the guys, I mean, it's going to be tough to be as successful as the Bulls were.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, Jordan was the star of the team in the series, obviously, but I wonder, do you think The Last Dance does a good job of highlighting the part that the other players played in the team's success, people like Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman?
I mean, it definitely does. I think, you know, when you look at this Last Dance docu-series that they put together. And, you know, a lot of people thought it was going to be mostly about Michael. But I think, you know, they've done a good job with Pippen and Rodman and talked about Kukoc and Kerr. And they've gave some backstory, you know, to some of the stuff that we might not have seen, you know, with Mike in the locker room and his emotional side. So, you know, I definitely think they've done a great job. And, you know, I've enjoyed watching it. I went back and watched the last two episodes a second and third time because it's so good. it's been awesome for me.
Yeah, wow. All right, so if you're just joining us, this is the 21st. We're talking with Rich McBride, the former Illinois basketball player, Springfieldian, and now the assistant men's basketball coach at Moberly Community College in Missouri. If you have memories of the Bulls watching the run in the 90s, particularly that last season, give us a call, 800-222-9455. That number again is 800-222-9455. You can also always tweet us at 21st Show. Once again, that is 21ST Show on Twitter. Rich, I think the bigger human stories are one of the reasons that we love sports, right? You have the emotion on the court, obviously, but also off the court. And I wonder if there are any stories in the series that stick with you about what was going on behind the scenes. I mean, there's so many great characters. It's almost like watching a play, right?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think, you know, the thing that stuck with me and, you know, being a young kid, I heard about Mike's dad, but I didn't know what really happened and nobody really explained it to me. So seeing that part of it, you know, and seeing him bounce back, you know, after going from baseball to back to basketball and just getting back to that level he was at when he left and then winning that championship on Father's Day, I mean, that was just remarkable. And, you know, seeing that emotion come out of him in that locker room, man, just being able to, you know, put everything to the side, put all that emotion to the side, get the job done for you, your teammates and your coaches, and then just to let it all out at the end, you know, on top. That was just remarkable for me.
All right, I want to play a clip from episode 7 of the series. Rich, I know you've now heard this several times since you said you went back and rewatched him, but I want to get your reaction to it. This is Michael Jordan speaking in the ESPN miniseries, The Last Dance.
Winning has a price. And leadership has a price. So I pulled people along when they didn't want to be pulled. I challenge people when they don't want to be challenged. And I earned that right because my teammates came after me. They didn't endure all the things that I endured.
Michael Jordan is down in pain. Detroit came down hard and is injured. Well, the Pistons have moved on, but you really got a feel for this man right here. I mean, playing his heart out.
Once you join the team, you live at a certain standard that I played the game, and I wasn't going to take any less. Now, that means I had to go in there and get in your ass a little bit, and I did that.
All right, so this is at the end of the episode where he's talking about his desire to win and what he did. You know, I wonder, Rich, you have been on the court, obviously. Do you think the Bulls won so much because of Jordan's kind of domineering style or in spite of it?
I definitely think that played a part in their success. I truly believe that you need that type of personality in a winning culture. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Sometimes, you know, it comes from your best player. Sometimes it comes from the head coach. Sometimes it comes from an assistant coach. But I think you definitely need that personality somewhere, you know, in that locker room to have a winning culture and to sustain it. You definitely need that.
All right. I understand we've got a caller on the line, Alita from Springfield. You have a comment. Well, good morning and welcome to the 21st.
Good morning. Yeah, I just wanted to mention I grew up in Springfield, went to Lamphere. My sisters went to school with Richard. I remember watching him play basketball with Andre and Quinn, and they had just like what he's talking about, where everybody's personalities were different, but they gelled really well. And I was fine when the Bulls won the 5th championship, and that really inspired me to have a love for basketball. And watching Rich and all the guys that he played high school ball with was really amazing.
All right. So inspiring a lot of kids, I wonder. I guess that, and that's sort of a theme here, I think, for those of us who were younger, and I was in college for the second run of the Bulls. But Alita, thank you for sharing your comments with us. And Rich, as we mentioned, you were also just a kid at the time this was happening. I wonder if seeing the series as an adult changes your perception of Jordan at all, or if it adds to your understanding of him as a player or even as a person.
I definitely, you know, as an adult, you definitely understand it a little bit more. I mean, you know, people could tell you stories and, you know, they can give you insight, you know, from what they thought or what they believed from when you were a teenager. But definitely seeing it now going through, you know, high school and college and now being on the other side as a coach. Like I said, I definitely, you know, respect Jordan, and, you know, there's only one Michael Jordan, and I think his personality definitely, you know, helped win them to have the run of championships that they had. And, you know, there's only one Michael Jordan for a reason, man. I think times are different now, but, you know, I definitely think that you need that personality somewhere in that locker room for that.
Yeah. You know, it's 20 years later and we are still returning to Jordan's story. I wonder, why do you think he has such staying power?
Excuse me.
I just wonder if do you have a sense of why? I mean, is it just his great basketball skills, or is there something beyond that about Jordan that gives him this kind of power that he stays in our minds even 20 years later? We're still talking about him.
Oh, I think, you know, that is definitely the skill. You know, it's definitely that. But I think it's winning. You know, what he was able to do, you know, going to 6 finals, not losing the finals, not going to a game 7 in the finals. I think that's, you know, what got him over the hump. Because, like I said, I think there's a lot of talented guys that came through the NBA, but a lot of them didn't win the amount of championships as Jordan was able to win in the fashion that he was able to win them in.
All right, we're also joined on the line now by Melissa Isaacson. She covered the Bulls for the Chicago Tribune in the 1990s. Nowadays, she's a lecturer at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism and an author. Her newest book is a memoir called State, A Team, A Triumph, A Transformation. Melissa Isaacson, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I want to ask, and just, we only have a couple of minutes left in the show here, but you covered the Bulls, right? And there's, in the first episode of The Last Dance, the Bulls are in Paris for an exhibition game. Streets are flooded with reporters and fans wanting a glimpse of Jordan. I imagine that was even crazier at home. And what was it like covering him in, you know, the Bulls in their heyday when you were with the Tribune?
Oh, incredible. I mean, you know, when you watch it now, obviously 30 years later, you have a perspective that's just, you can, you know, fully appreciate how huge it was. But I really think even during that time and experiencing it, we knew that it was something special. I mean, it was unlike anything. You knew you were watching someone who was maybe the best ever at that time, certainly the best player that we had ever seen. And, you know, you'd go on the road and you wouldn't be able to get into hotels, and the bus would be, you know, surrounded by people literally rocking it. You know, it was really like traveling with the Beatles, as I would imagine that would have been, you know, if you did. So it was incredible. It really was. It's, you know, seeing a player like him just on an everyday basis, seeing him play at the peak of his skills was really a blessing. I mean, it's all I could say, the highlight of my career for sure.
Yeah, and just about a minute left in our conversation, but and I asked this to Rich a moment ago, but it's 20 years later, we're still returning to Jordan's story. Why do you think he has such staying power in our imagination?
You know, my 22-year-old son was watching the documentary with me the other night, and he turned to me, and Michael was holding his cigar and the baseball bat in the other hand. I don't know if you guys remember that scene. Mm-hmm. And he looks at me and he goes, he was just so cool. And I was like, he was, you know, he had an aura about him. And certainly the skills are, you know, unsurpassed. And I'm really glad that younger people are getting to see him, because I teach undergrads and grads at Northwestern. And, you know, in the past when I've said, I think he's a better all-around player than LeBron, I think he's the greatest of all time, you get that skeptical look like you're an old person. I'm glad that people are seeing him, because he did have a style not just, you know, in the locker room, you know, laughing about that, but a style on the court that was unlike anyone else. And his clutch ability, his ability to hit big shots at big times, I think is unmatched. And so, you know, you just take all of that together and take the sheer numbers and his sheer ability. And all you have to do is just get a glimpse of one of these highlights and you know. And, and there's no coincidence that players are still wearing his gear and kids still know who he is.
20 years later. Melissa Isaacson covered the Bulls for the Chicago Tribune in the 1990s. And we also have been speaking with Rich McBride, who's the assistant men's basketball coach at Moberly Community College, but played for the U of I in the mid-aughts. Rich and Melissa, thanks so much for sharing your memories of Jordan with us today.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
That is all the time we have for today's show, which is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey.